Welcome back to the Thermodad Podcast. I'm your host, Jayden Miller, and today I have on the podcast Mr. Hans Amato from men-elite.com. I'm super excited for this episode. We talk about DHT, why it's so important, kind of how it compares to testosterone, how we can optimize our training and lifestyle in order to promote as much DHT and testosterone production as possible. We talk about the benefits of DHT. We also go into what a day in the life of a DHT optimizer looks like, such as Hans himself. And then we talk about a few other topics that are really interesting as well. I know that I learned a lot on this podcast, and I'm hoping that you can find value in the information that we provide. So without further ado, let's hop into this one. Welcome back to the Thermodiet Podcast. I'm your host, Jayden Miller. And today I have on the podcast, Mr. Hans Amato from Men Elite. How are you doing today, Hans?
Doing good, thanks, and you?
Doing well. So for the listeners out there who might not know who you are yet, do you mind kind of giving them a brief background and kind of where you're coming from?
Yeah, sure. I'm a researcher, experimenter, exerciser, writer, basically. So yeah, my main focus in life currently is just training, nutrition, optimizing health for longevity. I'm not focused on the short-term, long-term aspects, researching obsessively to find really what would be the best effect for longevity, contrary to what might be out there. And I guess that would be it.
Awesome. Heck yeah. How did you kind of get into the sphere of metabolic health?
Well, I was always interested in training, but then I came across the forum, the Ray Pete forum. I came across Ray Pete's work. And because I was familiar with how to optimize your androgens, such as you need a certain amount of saturated fat, cholesterol, carbohydrates, and it was kind of like easy for me to understand what he was saying. And it made a lot of sense, but obviously Pete wasn't focused on bodybuilding per se. So, you know, you have to integrate different aspects of, you know, his approach, and then also how to optimize bodybuilding in a way, but still, you know, get the best to optimize your longevity in a way. So that's basically when I really started focusing on the metabolism, because before then I wasn't really focusing on longevity per se. But then, you know, if you really break it down, you have to research the metabolism all the way down to the mitochondria. And then when you can understand like how energy is made, then you can understand how to optimize the metabolism and everything that falls into that, such as proper glucose oxidation, using things like methylene blue to enhance the electron transport chain, using ethyl pyruvate to enhance pyruvate dehydrogenase, just to ensure, you know, glucose oxidation is optimal. You've got that CO2 and ATP production going, and that will basically is the foundation of having an optimal metabolism, and that will ensure that you are kind of like having an optimal state of health. So your brain will be working well, your body will be working well when you're doing exercise, as well as your recovery, and that will help you to live longer, you know, as long as you're not being overly destructive with the way you're training.
Definitely. So your website is absolutely phenomenal. Like, you have all kinds of information on there. So for the listeners out there, definitely go check out menelite.com. And it's men-elite.
Yeah.
Men-elite.com. Definitely go check out his blog. But one of the things that you talk really well about is DHT. So can you kind of give us like a short definition of what DHT is and kind of how it compares to testosterone?
Okay. So DHT is considered to be the more stronger version of testosterone. And the reason why they say that's because it has a much higher affinity for the androgen receptor, and it stays on the androgen receptor much longer than testosterone. And it also can't be aromatized. So in a way, it's much stronger in terms of activation and retention. And when it comes to being androgenic, you want the activation of the androgen receptor. So obviously, you want to have optimal androgen receptor levels as well. But the thing is, like, DHT can enhance the androgen receptors. So DHT is responsible for many of the benefits of testosterone. And there's many studies that show that if you block the 5-alpha reductase enzyme, you lose many of the benefits of testosterone. For example, DHT is involved in cognition, so it's necessary for working memory. It activates or enhances the NMDA receptor in the brain that's needed for focus and that long-term potentiation of the brain. It also has benefits of neuroprotection and protects against neurodegeneration. And it's also actually promotes neurogenesis. So in many ways, it's very good for the brain as whole. And that is dependent on DHT, because if they can give you testosterone and an aromatase inhibitor or a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor, and they find that if they block the production of DHT, those benefits go away. So many of the benefits of estrogen and DHT might actually overlap a little bit, but there's obviously some discrepancies. For example, both estrogen and DHT might increase dopamine, which gives you that motivation and reward aspect. But then also estrogen enhances the breakdown of dopamine. So now you have higher dopamine, it's weaker breakdown. So you need more reward constantly. So they found that women are more prone to drug addiction and escalating the dose much faster than men are. So if you get a rapid spike in dopamine, but it's broken down quickly, you know, you have to get that rapid boost continuously. Whereas DHT can boost it and keep it high. So your basal level will stay higher and you will feel good constantly. And you need that DHT for that reward, where I can describe it like this, where just your motivation in life becomes a reflex instead of something that you have to think about. So if your DHT is high, you will automatically reflexively make a decision like, I want to go work on my business. I want to go and make money. So reflexively, that's going to push you in a positive direction, not necessarily an addictive drug direction. So in a way, DHT just makes men work better. So it is also anti-anxiety. It inhibits cortisol, the CRH in the brain. So that helps against stress, neuroinflammation, keeps you calm. So now you're in a much calmer, confident state, ready to focus on your goals. So I would assume that's kind of like what most men would want.
Definitely. Andrew Huberman, he is a neurobiologist at Stanford. I believe it's Stanford. And he says that testosterone and DHT tend to make effort feel good. And he also talks about how dopamine is not necessarily a reward measure, but it is a measure for motivation and kind of giving you that feel good feeling whenever you're in the process of getting somewhere as well. So I like that, definitely.
Yeah, for sure.
So whenever it comes to kind of training and lifestyle factors for increasing DHT production, what are some of the typical recommendations that you have for that?
Well, first of all, for DHT, I would focus on, when it comes to the diet, just make sure you optimize your testosterone. That would be the first step, because the DHT is converted from testosterone. So you want to make sure your testosterone is high to ensure good conversion rate. But then you also have to eliminate everything that might inhibit that conversion. So things like polyunsaturated fats, salt palmetto, green tea, perhaps a few. Even medicinal mushrooms might have strong inhibitory properties. So I know a lot of people will rather take something like lion's mane because it boosts BDNF and is supposedly good for the brain, but then it inhibits DHT, but they would rather do that, you know, because I think the boost in BDNF would be better than the loss of DHT, where I don't feel the same way. So optimizing your testosterone is key. So that goes for optimizing your micronutrients, your macronutrients, making sure you get the carbohydrates. And also zinc, like that's an important thing from your diet. And there are studies, in vitro studies, that would show that high doses of zinc can inhibit 5-alpha reductase. But if you look at the in vivo human studies, they've taken really high doses. I think it was like 250 milligrams for quite a long time, and their DHT went up, not down. So even if it might have a slight inhibitory effect in vivo, your DHT is still going up from that boost in testosterone. So if you want to eat a lot of oysters, most likely your DHT will go up. So just make sure that you can focus on increasing your testosterone. So everything that goes in line with that, and that will enhance the conversion to DHT. And then obviously you can take specific things that can enhance the conversion, like boron, or things that increase NADPH. That converts, that's a cofactor for the 5-alpha reductase enzyme. So things like vitamin B1, niacinamide can help to produce NADPH. Obviously, making sure you eat enough glucose, glycine, caffeine, and a few other things can help to upregulate DHT. But the most effective thing that I found, and that a lot of people have told me that worked for them, was just simply to do sprints. If you do really intense exercise, like a sprint, or I would say any exercise really intense. That can be weightlifting as well. Like you can do a snatch and clean, you can do muscle ups, you can do front levers, or anything that's going to recruit a lot of muscle mass. So that's the thing with a sprint, is that you're recruiting your whole body to do the sprint. Every muscle in your body is working very explosively. And if you do it correctly, like between 20 and 40, maybe even 50 yard sprints, you will be maximally activating all your muscles. And that's what you want when you want to boost your DHT production. If you go any longer, you will quickly start to fatigue your body. So you want to focus on short distance, short duration, focus only on using that creatine phosphate stores. Then you stop the sprint, you go back, rest, make sure your heart rate's going back to normal. It shouldn't stay elevated, maybe 2 to 3 minute rest, and then you can do another sprint. And once you start to fatigue too much, where you can't maintain that intensity, then it's important to scale down from that activity and rather rest, because then you're using up most of your glycogen, then your cortisol and stress hormones will start to kick in to create more glucose. And then you will, as your exercise performance goes down, obviously, you will start to mobilize more free fatty acids, which is not what you want. You want to focus mainly on that creatine phosphate stores and glycogen stores to support your energy expenditure when it comes to sprints. So the beautiful thing about sprints is that it doesn't only activate the production of testosterone, DHEA, and DHT in the muscle. But it also, I forgot what I was going to say. I was going to leading to, I think what I want to say is that exercise, if you increase DHT, that DHT specifically is responsible for, DHT has been found to activate or boost force production in the fast twitch muscles. So the more DHT you have, the more fast you could, force you can exert, and the faster you can sprint, and the more DHT you can produce in turn. So it's been found that if you block DHT, you get less force production, you get a drop in insulin sensitivity, and because the DHT helped you to utilize that glucose better. So the sprints will help to optimize your glucose oxidation in turn. And if your glucose oxidation is optimized, you will be able to be more explosive and create more DHT. So this whole thing comes down to, the way I like to say it's the foundation of everything is making sure your metabolism and glucose oxidation is optimal. If that is optimal, you will be able to do things like sprint that will optimize your DHT. So for example, if your metabolism is suffering and you're not oxidizing your glucose or fats, you're just not producing energy sufficiently, then your body can't create that testosterone. It can't convert that DHT, and your cells won't be able to respond as effectively to those hormones. So it's not as important to boost these hormones as to focus on your metabolism first. You don't want to be a sick person, start doing sprints, because you might not be able to do that force production. You might not be able to recover from that activity. You know, you must first boost your metabolism to a point where you can start to create a demand and then meet that demand with nutrition. So that's my approach, is that you make sure the metabolism is working optimally first, and then you can start focusing on all the other things. But because that, if you improve your metabolism, all those other things will improve as well. So for me, it feels like let's focus on the most important thing first, which is the metabolism, glucose oxidation, instead of let's just give you some glycine and caffeine to increase your DHT or putia superba or whatever the case may be. Yes, it might temporarily help with your sexual function, but you know, fixing the glucose oxidation, which will help every aspect of your life, is more important to me than focusing on your DHT.
Definitely. So what are some of the signs that someone is going over that stress threshold or isn't prepared yet to undergo that kind of stress?
I would say you have to test yourself. So you can do some form of activity, and then based on the symptoms that you experience, you decide the frequency that you're going to do that with, the intensity, the volume that you can do that exercise with. So a few of the symptoms that you can look out for is like, how do you feel afterwards? Like, is your muscles really sore? That's understandable if it's a new stimulus, you know, you can just adapt to that stimulus. But one of the simplest signs is that you feel off. You don't feel as energetic. You feel a little bit of brain fog. You feel you have the sniffles. That's a sure sign that you got some gut permeability and you absorb some endotoxins, and that's causing sniffles. You got sound sensitivity. You got light sensitivity in the eyes, which is basically signs of serotonin. So it's inflammation. And again, this kind of like, it's too reductionist to say it's an increase in serotonin, because that tryptophan can go through a variety of pathways. It's not just serotonin, but also the kyanin pathway that can create the overactivation of the NMDA receptor, which creates that sensitivity. So it's just you're destroying, being too destructive to your body can just create an overall reduction in every aspect of your life. So you just have to focus on, let's be sensitive and see which aspect of my life is being affected negatively by the stimulus that I'm giving my body. So I've with all the people that I've worked with, when I give them something that optimizes their glucose oxidation or their metabolism, let's say you give them aspirin or methylene blue or vitamin B1, they feel they can perform much better. So the worst of someone is the much better, they can feel they can perform better with these supplements that support their metabolism. So that can also be an indication of how much you can train and how you can adapt to that training. Because it's not necessarily how hard you can train because you can push yourself, but how you can recover from the training. You can't just sprint every second week and expect positive results. You can't be recovering for 2 weeks. You have to be able to sprint even every day if you're in a really healthy state, if your nutrition is on point. Yeah.
So what would you say an average day of DHT optimization looks like for you?
Well, okay. So starting in the morning, starting the night before, obviously proper sleep. So you wake up after your night of very restful sleep. You preferably make yourself something. What I typically would do is I get myself some milk, honey, throw in some coffee, which would be about 100 milligrams of caffeine, I think. Then I go outside in the sun and drink that in the sun. So I get that sunlight, that near infrared in my body that is optimizing my cellular function. And just, you know, getting everything ready in the day. Like near infrared is the most abundant versus the UV in the first half of the day. So that near infrared then obviously helps to structure your water in the body. It enhances cellular function. It increases the antioxidants in your cells. So it just makes you just better overall. So then after that, I don't take a lot of supplements, but then I would basically start working and I would continually fuel myself during the day. So that would be typically depending, I tend to listen to my body a lot. So some days I might want to drink more milk. Some days I would want to eat more meat. So if I don't feel like I want to eat more meat, I just drink more milk with honey and coffee. Sometimes I might take a little bit of aspirin depending on how I feel. And lately I've been taking much more methylene blue, like 20 milligrams. I'm experimenting with that. In the past, I did a 60 milligram methylene blue experiment. Then I stopped and I started again just to see the effects on my body. And I definitely feel much better energy at that dose. And again, like everyone is different and I recommend that everyone experiment with their own dose. And I go on symptom. How do I feel? Is this supplement really, you know, taking me to where I want to be? And then I'm not going past that dose. So then I would start working, just typical research, answering emails, maybe talking to a client. And then I typically wait about, I would say five to six hours before I do my workout, which is just an intense 20 to 30 minute workout. So I make sure I've been fueling up big time before I work out. And I think this is the thing that a lot of people overlook is that they just even train fasted or they don't fuel up enough. And then they get some kind of stress reaction. They feel brain fog the rest of the day. They feel tired and they don't know that it's actually the exercise that caused it. So I always make sure I fuel up properly. I have a pre-workout, inter-workout, post-workout, which would typically be apple juice at the moment. Now it's becoming winter, so I'm going to get oranges, make myself some orange juice. Then I take a teaspoon of sodium bicarbonate because that helps with exercise performance, endurance. And I take 10 grams of creatine. Creatine has been shown to enhance DHT of the workout, but also just to enhance fat loss as well and muscle mass gain. It's really effective. And interestingly enough, a study has shown that if you take creatine, that changes your sleep patterns. So you might need less sleep. And people that are typically sleep deprived, which is actually very common these days, is that sleep deprivation lowers your brain glycogen. And creatine can help to replenish that. So any of those cognitive defects that you get from sleep deprivation, creatine can help to fill in for that. So that's really cool. So then post-workout, just more milk with honey, replenish my glycogen stores, get some protein to my system. So that would typically be a day where I don't do sprints. And on days that I do sprint, I do the sprints first, maybe 2 hours after waking in the sun outside. And then I would wait about 3 to 4 to 5 hours before I do my workout again, just make sure I'm replenishing enough to do my workout. And when the sprints, I'm just doing currently 5 sets of 30-yard sprints. And I might modify that sometime in the future. I don't know. But that typically feels right to me. If I feel I have to do more than that, I won't be able to exert that maximal output that I'm currently doing. So, you know, you have that first and maybe second set is a little bit of a warm up, so to speak. And then the third, fourth, and fifth set is just like max output all the time. So just like spiking your heart rate, you're activating all your muscles. And that's basically going to skyrocket your DHT in the process. And then refuel. I mostly eat low fat, and that helps to accelerate the metabolic rate. Research have found that if you eat low fat post-workout, that creates kind of like a fat deficit, and that can like boost the metabolic rate. So I just make sure that I stay low fat most of the day. I get my cholesterol from either beef kidney or egg yolks. And I sometimes structure my egg yolks as a pre and a post-workout as well, because the egg yolks specifically has been shown to enhance muscle protein synthesis hypertrophy compared to just the egg white. So cholesterol itself and maybe many other components in the yolk itself is highly anabolic. And then a few times a week, I have oysters. I have these giant oysters that I have. I just swallow them raw for extra minerals, just highly beneficial. And I try not to work too late. I don't do the blue blocker stuff. I don't feel like I need that. My sleep is good enough. Apart from that, supplements that I take, I don't really take supplements. I've tried experimented a little bit with ornithine before bed, as that has been shown to help with the circadian rhythm. I think that has helped. But the thing that has really made the most improvement for me for sleep has been just using thyroid, which is 2 drops of the Thyro Mix from Idea Labs sublingually. And I feel my sleep onsets faster, my sleep depth is better, and I feel I need less sleep. And I wanted to mention, now that I talked about but now I forgot again. I think it will come up to me again, but yeah. Anyway, so I bone broth. I also do bone broth, about a cup, sometimes 2 cups. I would do 1 cup pre-workout, as the peptides in the collagen has been shown to also be beneficial for muscle mass gains and fat loss. And then the last cup is just before bed, as that can also help with sleep and just the recovery during the day. So as I mentioned, glycine can also help to boost DHT. So that would be basically my protocol. Just avoid any foods that is gut irritating. You don't want to create endotoxin, as that can damage the testicles and, you know, the brain and everything, just lower the whole cascade that creates testosterone and converts to DHT. So I typically avoid anything that can cause harm to my system or inflammation. And now I've reached this baseline where you're very sensitive to anything that can potentially bring you down a notch. You know, and this is the thing that a lot of people are not that at that level where they are sensitive to know what is affecting them negatively. Like, what should I cut out of my diet? I don't know, because, you know, you're not at that baseline. You eat rice, for example, and you get some sniffles, but you always have sniffles. Like, how do you know it's the rice that's giving you the sniffles? So just by eliminating everything that could potentially cause you issues, makes you very sensitive. And then you can add things in, like some people don't get the sniffles from rice. Then you can have rice, of course. So I guess that would be my simplistic approach.
Awesome. How do you cook your beef kidney? Because that's a organ that I've been wanting to try, but I'm not really sure how to cook it in a way that is sustainable, I guess.
Sustainable in which, like, taste or what way?
Both. I would say taste and from a nutrition standpoint.
Okay. Yeah, I typically would do either a 50-50 mix or a 1-to-4 ratio between kidney and ground beef. So I would have like 100 to 200 grams of kidney and then 300 to 400 grams of ground beef. And I just blend the kidney, mix it with my ground beef, and that basically muffles the taste. And then I put it in the pan, put the lid on. I don't add any fat or water or anything. Put it on a low heat. The heat will then allow the water and the fat to come out of the meat in the kidney, and they will basically be cooked in that water and fat. So by the time that the meat is ready, all the water has been evaporated. So you don't have to like drink your meat. So, mm-hmm. And because you're using a low heat, the cholesterol is not being oxidized, because high heat obviously oxidizes the cholesterol. So just by consuming, I think it was like 200 grams of kidney, you're getting about 1.2 to 1.3 grams of cholesterol. So it's much better than eggs, in my opinion.
So do you ever use any other organs like liver or heart or anything like that?
I did in the past. I do have liver, but I eat it very infrequently. I have been experimenting with not having liver, because in the past I was consuming like half a pound of copper every day for a couple of weeks. So I was pretty sure I got access of copper. So I'm just experimenting to see like if I might get copper symptoms if I don't eat it. But the thing is, I'm eating oysters, I'm still getting copper. So I don't feel the need to be consuming extra liver. But in terms of heart, I feel that I get all my nutrients from the ground beef and the kidney or the other food I eat. So I don't feel like I have to eat more organ meat. And the time when I was eating it, I don't really feel much of a benefit. I really want to rely on the food that makes the most difference for me. So that would be an egg yolk. I really can feel like my recovery is faster when I have egg yolk. And like the kidney is a good source. The bone broth, the milk, all those things are very simple foods that will have the best impact on my life.
So how did you end up figuring out that these specific foods worked for you?
Well, I would, that's a good question. Like I didn't really, one of the main determinants of why I eat a food is based on their micronutrient profile. So I have tried to eliminate milk, but then it makes it very difficult to get certain nutrients. And I'm just like, milk is so nutrient dense. I love drinking it. I have no issue with it. I'm just going to have it in my diet. It's like, there's no reason to eliminate it. And it makes things so easy. The same thing with the kidney. You just throw in 200 grams of kidney or even 100 grams and you're getting so many micronutrients. And the same thing with liver. It's just a thing, you can't eat liver every day. Otherwise, you might get too much vitamin A and copper, which is not something that I want at the moment. And oyster, obviously, is a no-brainer. Very high in micronutrients. And then I also go on cravings, as I mentioned. I sometimes drink up to 5 liters of milk a day, and that's all I consume. And sometimes I would have only 2 liters and have much more meat. So sometimes I crave something more salty and beef, then I have that. Sometimes I don't, then I don't have it. So I just basically make sure I consume a certain amount of calories, make sure I consume a certain amount of protein, carbohydrates, make sure my carbohydrate to protein ratio is about 1:3, 1:4. Just make sure my, you know, I want to get my RQ, that CO2 production, really high at the moment. Like that's really helpful for healing, regeneration, blood flow, anti-inflammation. So that's basically how I decide to eat things. I first look at the micronutrients. Do I enjoy it? Does it make my life convenient? I guess that's that.
So are you drinking raw milk right now?
No, sadly. The thing is, like, we can buy raw milk from a farm close here, but if you look at how they do it, it's not in a very clean way. They're not suited for people to actually buy raw milk. Like, they don't even wash the udder when they clean it. And sometimes when they've gotten milk from there, you will see little bits of poop, you know, coming into the container that you're having. So they obviously send it away and they filter it. And when you buy it raw, it's not filtered. So yeah, I was thinking that the quality wasn't any better. I was thinking the store-bought was actually better because it was filtered, pasteurized. There wasn't any risk of contamination. And but ideally, I think I would get some, I would enjoy raw milk instead, but at the moment, it's just not all that plausible.
So whenever it comes to increasing glucose oxidation, what would you say are 3 to 5 of the highest leverage factors that someone could implement right now?
It depends on their state of health. So I would say just eat more glucose. That's the simplest way to upregulate, because glucose is one of those factors. It's the only macro that can upregulate its own synthesis. There's many studies that show that glucose intake correlates with glucose oxidation, whether it be 200 grams or 600 milligrams, you're going to be oxidizing almost all of those carbohydrates in that day that you consume it. So your RQ will be very high. And only about, like, you know, even though de novo lipogenesis might be upregulated from all that carbohydrate, it's still about creating 5 to 10 grams of fat, which is a very small amount. And it's not like you're going to get fat from that amount, because your metabolic rate is faster from all that carbohydrates that you're eating. So what was the question again? Sorry, I think I got lost track.
3 to 5 high leverage factors for increasing glucose oxidation.
Sorry, man.
Good.
Okay, so just eat more carbohydrates. Then obviously the next step would be just make sure your stress is low, because stress then messes with the glucose oxidation. So if your stress is high, that's going to inhibit pyruvate dehydrogenase. It's going to mobilize free fatty acids. That's also going to inhibit proper glucose oxidation. Just make sure your stress hormones are low, and you can do that with like aspirin. I really like aspirin, but you can do it with other adaptogens as well, such as phosphatidyl serine, rhodiola, ashwagandha, or whatever the case may be. And then you can use factors that upregulate glucose oxidation. I really like vitamin B1. Thyroid. I have to make good choices here. And I have to include methylene blue, but I also really want to include caffeine. So caffeine is just a really good booster of the metabolism. And for those people that get jittery from it, you can just take like theanine. It's been shown to really help to combat that. So I myself never get any jitters from it, even if I consume really high amounts. So you can actually see it as the energy matrix, because all of these supplements will act on a different area, and you want to optimize every single area of your glucose oxidation. So first, like I mentioned, you want to inhibit axis lipolysis so that the fatty acids is not inhibiting glucose oxidation. Then you want to make sure the pyruvate dehydrogenase is upregulated to make sure that you're using your glucose correctly. So that would be magnesium, vitamin B1, and niacinamide, vitamin B2. Alpha lipoic acid can also help, but the half-life is very short. And I really like Pyrocet from Idea Labs. It contains ethyl pyruvate. And the ethyl pyruvate is much stronger than calcium pyruvate, which you typically get from someplace like bulk supplements. I have experimented between the calcium pyruvate, ethyl pyruvate, or at least Pyrocet, and I've always felt that the Pyrocet is much stronger. And if you look at the studies, it shows it's about 10 to 100 times stronger. And also it can, my hypothesis is that it can enter more tissue than the calcium pyruvate, because there was a study when they compared the, I think it was sodium pyruvate with ethyl pyruvate in the brain. The ethyl pyruvate upregulated glucose oxidation in more areas of the brain than the sodium pyruvate. Mm-hmm. So it's just, it's stronger and more effective. And I just feel the Pyrocet much better. I feel this clean energy, and I feel calm whenever I use it. So I would always recommend rather using the ethyl pyruvate compared to the calcium pyruvate. Then in the Krebs cycle, did you have a question?
That actually makes a lot of sense. Like, do you think it's because there's a lack of ionic exchange so the ethyl pyruvate can get into the cell more easily?
That could be. I don't know. Perhaps just if the ethyl part is just allowing it to have a longer half-life. So in that way, it can also, you know, allowed, and so to speak, to enter the cell more effectively. In some ways, it's not. I don't know why exactly it's better, but I just feel it's better.
Awesome. Sorry. Please continue.
Yeah. Okay. So the next step would just be the Krebs cycle from pyruvate dehydrogenase, and it's the oxidative stress that's the main thing that inhibits the Krebs cycle, because it oxidizes some of those iron clusters enzymes. So then, for example, the citrate, the aconitase is the enzyme that converts the citrate to the next one. So if that enzyme is being oxidized by oxidative stress, then the citrate will enter the exit the mitochondria and be used for de novo lipogenesis. So that's when you get intramuscular fat accumulation, fatty liver, or stuff like that. So just to make sure you lower the oxidative stress can ensure that the Krebs cycle is spinning faster. And one of the enzymes is also requires NAD. So just to make sure your NAD to NADH ratio and the FAD to FADH ratio is high, so the Krebs cycle can turn. And this is where DHT is also beneficial, because DHT upregulates pyruvate dehydrogenase, aconitase, and complex 2 of the electron transport chain. And DHT also upregulates cytochrome C. So those are involved with the electron transport chain. So then after the Krebs cycle, you get the electron transport chain, which is kind of like the last step when it comes to energy production. And for that, I typically would like methylene blue if I have to choose just one. And then you can obviously combine it with red light, because that also helps with the cytochrome C and just general structure of the cell and energy production. And a few other compounds would be succinic acid is good for enhancing complex 2. You get vitamin K, the MK4 version, helps with complex 3. You get the dihydroascorbic acid, which helps with complex 1. So if you combine the ascorbic acid or dihydroascorbic acid, because it can be recycled, with vitamin K and methylene blue and perhaps even succinic acid, that's a massive combo, then you can completely like support the electron transport chain if there is really defects going on. So that would be kind of like the major things that I focus on, and obviously just avoid the polyunsaturated fats. And this also counts for the omega-3, because they can be incorporated into the cardiolipin, and the cardiolipin are those fatty acid structures that stabilizes these complexes of the electron transport chain that allow the electron transport chain to work better. So these fatty acids, especially omega-3, make the cardiolipin very fluid. So then you get electron leak out of the electron transport chain, reacts with oxygen, reacts with the lipids, oxidizes the lipids, and the whole structure loses function. And then you get more buildup of NADH because it can't donate that hydrogen into the complex, depending on what complex that is, obviously. So then you get more oxidative stress, more electron leak. So PUFAS is just bad. If you want to optimize your electron transport chain, just make sure that you keep the PUFAS low. But that's just easy to do if you just consume milk, meat, a little bit of eggs, and just avoid all the vegetable, nut, and seed oils. And then you're basically good to go. Or I would say basically try to limit your PUFA below 10 grams a day. I think that would be a good amount to shoot for. But typically, I try to keep it below 5 for me. And I think that would be my list for optimizing glucose oxidation. But if I had to summarize back to the top 5, it would be vitamin B1 and magnesium, depending on your status. Caffeine, pyrocet, methylene blue. I think that would be my top stack. And then obviously aspirin, just to keep the stress low. Aspirin's just also great.
So from a physiological and a psychological side, how do you usually keep stress in check?
I would say I don't have a lot of stressors in my life, except for obviously running a business. That could be stressful, you know, because you have to do planning, you have to do so many things, like you yourself know. You know, it takes time, it takes planning, and that can be stressful. But if you get into the groove of everything and you do proper planning and you understand how to do things, then you can really manage that stress. But I would say other than that, exercise is a big one. Sleep is a big one. But obviously you have to get rid of that stress before you go to bed, else it might disrupt your sleep. Then obviously getting out in nature is a big one. I don't do meditation. I don't do breathing exercises. Music is a very big one that can help to snap you out of it. Just getting away from the stressor is a big one. So let's say that's why, let's use couples for an example. You know, you're arguing with your partner, you feel really mad, and then you just go walk away. And then within an hour, you come back, you're much calmer, and you can just talk out whatever might be the case. So getting away from the stressor, just walking, clearing your mind might be beneficial. And very important for people that don't know this is that if you're not properly fueled, you become much less stress resilient. So if you're properly fueled with glucose, you're very stress resilient. And every time blood sugar drops, you get angry, you get frustrated, you have a short temper, you can't manage that stress. But if you can buffer that stress with the carbohydrates, you can keep calm in every situation and think of solutions instead of reacting in a negative way.
Definitely. I would say that the lack of stresses in your life is definitely from setting it up properly. So kudos for doing that, for sure. That's hard for most people to do. So what does an average day of training look like for you right now? You said it's usually around 20 to 30 minutes on non-sprint days. What does that usually consist of?
Well, okay, currently I actually want to do a full body workout 3 times a week, but because of many years of powerlifting squats, duck stance, you know, feet out, and also Parkour injuries, I have gotten flat foot. I've injured my ankle, and as a result of that, I've got, you know, flat foot that has led to knee issues, hip issues, all the way up into the shoulder issues, and so I've basically been focusing on fixing all the compensations that I've got as a result of that. Because, you know, if you get an injury, some muscles will go lax and others will tighten up as a compensation. So you have to strengthen that muscle that's not been working for a long time and relax. And automatically these will relax and you will get gain equilibrium again. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing, you know, so many people's like, let's get rid of the spasms. It's like, oh, it's spasms for a reason. And you have to strengthen this one. So that's the thing about you want your body to be completely connected. If it's not connected, it has compensations. So I'm working with this guy. He's helping me getting rid of my compensation. So I'm only doing an upper body workout 3 times a week, which is one set max out to to death, as I would like to say, because it's really hard. I train with, I mix rings, weights, resistance bands. And I really like resistance bands because you overload the whole range of motion of the movement. You know, if you're doing a bench press, it's really hard at the bottom. It gets so easy up top. So if you use a resistance bands, you know, you get that full stimulation. And as a result of training like this, I've really seen my muscle development. But I would say size, but if you take measurements, the size hasn't necessarily increased, but the development, and that also makes you look bigger, has improved tremendously from the style of training. So it comes down to really activating that muscle that you're training maximally and then stopping. Because I found that even a 45 to a 60 minute workout that's considered normal can become stressful even if you rest like 3 to 5 minutes. Like if you're doing a set and you're resting and then a set, you're using your glycogen. And all those studies have shown that that doesn't necessarily increase cortisol. That's not the best way that I have found for me to get an adaption. So that's why I also have intra workout carbohydrates. And I feel that at the end of my workout, my endurance is still very good. But if I don't have intra workout carbohydrates, I can feel definitely like a slowing down. And I typically don't want that slowing down. That's like, I don't know, this guy has a weird name, but you might recall who he is. He uses essential amino acids like pre-workout, inter-workout, and post-workout just to make sure you've got that essential amino acids in your blood all the time. There's actually been a recent study on that to show that it's effective. You want to make sure, you know, you've got those amino acids in your blood. You also want to make sure you've got this glucose in your blood because that's how you adapt properly. You know, if you build a house and then you break it down, you build it, are you ever going to go anywhere with that house because you're constantly just building it down? You want to stimulate it and then build on that. And then you're taking steps forward. So that's basically what I'm doing. Training intense, getting out, making sure my nutrition is on point. And then on sprint days, which has only been once a week, but I'm bumping that up to 2 and then I'm going to up to 3 times. I'm just working up slowly because I started recently. Then I would do the sprints, as I mentioned, rest, and then I do the workouts. I'm not sure if I'm going to continue doing traditional style bodybuilding leg workouts, though. Exercises, I'm doing specific exercises to get rid of the compensations, help me connect better, help me to sprint better. So these exercises will also serve to build mass and definition. So in that regard, I'm not, and also I feel like my legs are big enough. Like if you want to look aesthetic, you don't want your legs to be overpowering the physique. So as long as you have like good size legs with good development, and then all is good. And for my goals specifically, I want to be explosive. I want to be athletic. So now I'm doing this sprint training to connect my body better to be able to achieve my goals. So I think that's basically my workouts. And I really like to focus on the compound style workout. So instead of doing a bench press, I'm doing push-ups on rings where I have a weight belt and the weight's hanging down from my chest and also the resistance band around. So my whole body is being activated when I do the exercise. It's not where on a bench, you know, the whole body is kind of like deactivated in an unnatural position where you're benching out. So I like to focus on the compound movements, but I also obviously still do the isolation movements. But yeah, that's basically my workout.
Do you mind giving the guy that you're working with a shout out? Is there any places we can go for information as far as those places go?
I haven't seen that he has social media or a website, but let me see. His name is Alex, and I'm going to butcher his last name because he's Russian. It's Shmolovich, and I apologize if that is just butchering, but I'm going to do a podcast with him soon, and then I'll give his full name, just spell it out for everyone, and I'm going to be talking about his philosophy about training. He's like a professional tennis player. So I'm really looking forward to, because he has a very different approach when it comes to training, when it comes to the nervous system. But just keep in mind, he's not focused towards bodybuilding, but towards enhancing exercise performance. So just as a disclaimer. But yeah, I'm looking really forward to that podcast, just to pick his brain on everything nervous system and how that connects to training. And it's basically some of these things that I've been talking about now. You have to do a maximal stimulus, activate the body, and just stop doing it because you can only adapt to a maximal stimulus. But I'm going to release that podcast. It could be very interesting.
Heck yeah. Awesome. I'm ready to listen to it whenever it comes out.
Cool, man.
So what kind of other stuff are you looking into right now? What's kind of piquing your interest?
I was thinking, I'm really juggling podcasting with articles at the moment, but I really enjoy doing articles. And I feel like that's just such a good resource for people to continually go back to. Whereas with a podcast, it's much more difficult to, you know, find the right place. And, you know, there's no transcript or whatever the case may be. But I do find like you can balance the articles and the podcast. I think that's a good balance. But for me, I was also doing YouTube videos where I feel that that will take too much time and effort to create something that's really high quality to match with an article. So I'm just going to focus all my attention on articles and podcasting. So currently when I'm going to release an article this Friday, it's going to be on fat loss on the Ray Peet style. And that's because nice. There's this common misconception that people are afraid of oxidizing fat. And I know I'm also, you know, all about maximizing your glucose oxidation. But the thing is, you're always burning fat at all times. You know, you can't escape from that. So now people's like, okay, I don't want to go into a deficit because I'm going to be burning more fat. But if you look at the studies, like one way you can compensate that is just to increase your carbohydrate content. Let's say you're eating a diet 50% carbohydrates and you bump that up to 70% carbohydrates and you go into a 30% deficit. That's a pretty big deficit. Your RQ, meaning your glucose oxidation, will remain the same. Your CO2 production for the amount of oxygen that you're consuming will be remaining the same. So that's one way just to compensate for the deficit. So I would recommend, you know, obviously going to a smaller deficit, like 10%, and then you just have to bump up your calories, I mean your carbohydrates by like about 10%, just to compensate for that. So just to make sure you're still oxidizing your glucose, you're optimizing your CO2 production. And then while minimizing the stress from the deficit, obviously small deficit, and then obviously you have to make sure your thyroid's in order. And the thing I'm pointing out in that article is that things that we consider as beneficial, like thyroid, testosterone, DHT, they also promote fat oxidation. Like they stimulate the metabolic rate, promote fat and glucose oxidation. And that's the whole point, that if you look at omega-3s, and this is actually a seasonal thing, is that in the winter, they promote oxidation of fat at the expense of glucose, but your metabolic rate stays the same. And that's not a good thing. You want to boost your metabolism. You want to promote both fat and glucose oxidation. But the very important thing is that, or interesting thing I would say, is that people that are hyperthyroid actually oxidize much more fat than people that are euthyroid. So if they go for treatment to reduce their thyroid function, their RQ actually increases, meaning they are oxidizing less fat and more glucose. So even something as beneficial as thyroid, you know, boost your fat oxidation. So fat oxidation is not something to be afraid of. It's just the excess fat oxidation that is problematic, or these people that obviously promote low carb diets or fasting, those things are suboptimal.
Definitely. So you said that article's coming out Friday?
Friday. And then I'm going to focus on, I was thinking about metabolic rate and longevity, because I know that's also a major misconception where, you know, you have to be cold, you have to be fasting, you have to be caloric deficiting all your life. So I want to do an article on that, but I also want to do one on weed. Is weed really beneficial? And I guess I can talk a little bit about that if that's okay.
Definitely.
You mean
cannabis specifically?
Yeah, cannabis specifically.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So the THC basically, but I think the CBD is relatively okay. So from my own experience and from the experience working with other people and what they've told me is that weed is a big motivation killer in life. And it also is very detrimental to sexual function. Your testosterone production is just negative in this whole aspect. So many people that I've talked to, if they tell me I have anhedonia, I have depersonalization, I have a disconnection from reality, it's like, okay, did you smoke weed? Yeah, I smoked weed. It's like, okay. Like, so there's this really strong connection between weed and depersonalization, anhedonia, low motivation. So I really want to focus on, that is why, let's say when you were going through puberty and you were in your early 20s, you were having a robust sexual life. Then you started smoking weed. At the end of your 20s, you're not having a robust sexual life. It's like, okay, it's the weed that has caused those, or most likely because people don't only smoke weed, they also eat junk food. So there's multiple factors, but I really want to bring awareness to the fact that weed can be detrimental to your sexual function, but also your motivation in life. Because if you don't have motivation, you can't pursue your goals, you can't start your business, you can't ask for a promotion, you can't work harder because you're not really seeing that goal, which we basically talked about. You're not feeling that reward from the achievement that you got. And I just want to bring awareness of that, because a lot of people think it hit the media big time, you know, the past few years, and everyone is thinking weed is so beneficial. But you really have to be careful when you do smoke weed, because it can have negative effects. And from my own experience, that's definitely what I have experienced from weed and the people that I've worked with.
Definitely. Yeah. I would say that that could definitely be the case. And like, when you say that, the conspiracy theorist in my mind tends to think that that could be like the legalization of the marijuana could be a way to keep the mass population at bay a little bit.
Yeah, actually, we watched Godzilla, the new one, yesterday, and it was, they had basically this conspiracy theorist. It's like they're putting fluoride in the tap water, you know, to reduce your IQ and make you more acceptable to the government and everything. So that was just funny. Yeah, no, I think that might play a role. The conspiracy theorist in me agrees.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Do you think that there was also some truth in that statement on the movie as well?
I think so, but obviously I would rather see it as, I would support both sides. So first of all, let's say they had an abundance of fluoride, and okay, let's take, what was that example? I think it was polyunsaturated fats. Okay, so it was omega-6, you know, that seed oils that Pete talked about. So it was initially, they used it as varnish. So then there came artificial varnish. So now there wasn't a market for the omega-6 anymore. And now they market it as health foods. So the same thing is with the fluoride and so many different things. I think Pete even mentioned with fiber. People like refined foods, but now they can't make money with the fiber. You know, let's try to make extra money if we think fiber is good for your gut. So the same thing with the fluoride is that they want to make money with as many things as possible. But it's like, instead of let's not dump the fluoride somewhere. You know, we can make use of that, put it in toothpaste, put it in water. And as a side bonus, we reduce the IQ of people. But obviously that's just conspiracy theorist stuff. But of course, it's not conspiracy stuff, because if there's so many evidence of how they can control people when you have these military vehicles with these, they can send frequency into people and then control their behavior in a way that makes them really aggressive. And then after they have stimulated the crowd, they can just spray, lithium back into the crowd, calm everyone down. So it's not about conspiracy, it's about how are they really using this technology? And the research clearly states that fluoride is bad for your health. You know, it poisons your neurons, your thyroid, your testes, whatever the case may be. But they're just turning a blind eye because they're making money from it. So I wouldn't say they are inherently evil, which some people are. But they want to make money. You know, money is a major driver in society.
Mm, definitely. Do you think that might be one of the beneficial aspects of music, is just sending those different wave frequencies into people?
Perhaps, but also keep in mind that everyone has a different taste in music, so you're not going to get the same frequency. And it's interesting that they have found that the slower music more stimulates oxytocin, whereas the more upbeat music can stimulate dopamine. So you get different effects. Whereas let's say I like rock music and I get a nice dopamine boost from that, where someone else might get a nice dopamine boost from like rock music. So it depends on what they like. But it's also been found that, I think it was like extreme rock music, or not rock, metal, hard rock, hard metal, but whatever the terminology may be, stimulated cortisol. So it was kind of like a stressor. So I don't know why people, well, now we're going into psychology, you know, but you can feel that anger is motivating you in life. You know, there's different things that can motivate you in life, and anger, fear is major motivators in life. So if you listen to the music, it's making you angry. You know, you're becoming re-stimulated, focusing on your goals. And like, why do you have a certain goal? Let's find the emotion behind that goal. Sometimes it's anger. Sometimes it's fear. Sometimes, you know, you have to find that whatever's motivating you. And why do you like what you like?
What would you say is your primary motivation right now?
What do you mean, like for what specifically, or just in general?
I would say for your business, maybe, and then generally speaking.
Well, my main goal was always freedom. So I know there's like money creates freedom. It's just a fact of modern life is that the more money you have, the more likely you are to have freedom. But that's not always the case because people trade their time for money. So you're just becoming a slave to your money. So for me, it was creating freedom, and whatever measure I had to take to get that freedom, I had to do that, but not in a evil way, so to speak. You know, you don't want to do it in an unright, injustice way. You still want to be helpful to people and actually make money in a helpful way. And apart from freedom, you know, then why do you want freedom? It's because that creates less stress in your life. Like, you want to be happy, you don't want to stress, you want freedom for that. And so let's say you have more freedom, what are you going to do with your more freedom? Okay, well, now I can be more productive and create even more content for people that can help them. Like, that is what I enjoy to do. I really enjoy doing research, creating content, and helping people in that way. But let's say now you're a coach, now you're still trading your time for money, you know, so that is in a way not giving you freedom. So what are you going to do with your knowledge that's going to give you freedom? So there's different ways that you can do it. Maybe you can write a book, you know, you can be an author and perhaps depend on that for your money, or there's a variety of different ways. Maybe you can even be an investor and make money that way, create your freedom, and then do what you really love to do. Because if you really enjoy what you love to do, you can benefit humanity. Because then you can, let's say you want to make music, then you can make really good music and you're not driven by your producer to produce music. It's like you have a deadline, do this, do that. And then your best self can't come out to create the best music. So if you have freedom, you can do so many good things, you know, at your own time. It's not that you're going to be bumming on a beach. Like, I would be bored out of my mind. That's not my goal at all. Like, I still want to train, make instructional videos. Let's help other people achieve their goals with androgens, training, health, metabolism, whatever the case may be. So I think that's my biggest motivator.
That's awesome. Well, I'm really grateful for you hopping on here today. I want to be respectful of your time. So where can people find you on social media? They already know your website, men-elite.com, all that good stuff.
Yeah, I basically have a newsletter. If people want to check that out, they could just go to my homepage, sign up. There's a link. And there I basically announce every time I create new content. So I always make sure I share a lot of great content on there that I never share anywhere else. So you'll always benefit from that newsletter as well. But then if I make a podcast, which would be audio or video or on YouTube, I will always share it there. But if you want to follow me, you can go to my YouTube. Like, I always forget the names of my social media. So you can just go to the website. All the links will be there. And that's what, but I would really recommend like the newsletter. That's where I just give all the outlets if I created new content.
Heck yeah. Awesome. I know that I personally enjoy Fun Fact Fridays for sure. I always enjoy when that hits my inbox Friday mornings. So
great, man. Glad to hear. Yeah. And really thank you for this opportunity to talk with you again. I really enjoyed it.
Definitely. I did as well. But sweet. All those of you listening, make sure to go check out his website, check out his YouTube channel and his Instagram. I've been enjoying your Instagram recently. Your past few posts have been really good. I enjoyed the thyroid one was really good here recently as well.
Yeah, I tend to be a little bit inactive, but when I have content, I try to make it good. Yeah, I don't really, that's not really a major focus for me. But I want to do it more. But it always feels like other things gain more importance over that one.
Definitely. Well, Hans, I appreciate your time and we'll talk again soon.
It's my pleasure, man. Talk soon.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you haven't already, make sure to hit the like button, subscribe, and leave a comment down below if you want us to cover a different topic.